And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio. We're trying to just sort out a few technical issues in the background here with our guest, who apparently is unable to pick up his connection there. So you'll have to bear with us. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, it's going to be very, very nice show for you. I can assure you of that. Because we have a famous face, right? Famous man, rather. You ever heard of the savings and loan scandal, right? See, instantly, everybody's like, wait, I have heard of that. I don't know what it is. Yeah, but when you think about it, you never wonder about who actually brought that scandal out into the limelight. There's a similar case in New Zealand where a whole bunch of politicians and leading New Zealanders were getting away with tax dodging, etc. Called the Winebox Inquiry. Everybody remembers that. They don't know what it was or who brought it into the limelight. It was actually another politician, interestingly enough, who later got ousted from the party he was a part of and started his own. Now, let's think about this. Economics, money, the stock market, these things are far too complicated for the ordinary person. You're like, oh, well, it's... But no. Sometimes it's actually quite simple. Have a look at how much money there is. Never look at how few people have it all. There's your answer. What's money for? It's to keep control of people for the benefit of a few. Rather, that's what the control of money handed away to private banks, and also those banks being able to create that money out of nothing. That's the kind of problem it presents, because it gives undue leverage to other people. Now, AFR, we appear to have our guest, Bill Black, on the Skype. He's gone green, so if you want to add him to the call, that'd be fantastical. Also, I wanted to relay to people the importance of financial issues. My very special guest, who is indeed somebody to be noted, not only in history, but also today, is Bill Black, who is a key figure in exposing corruption by members of Congress called the Keating Five. After Senator Charles Keating, who there was a note from a diarist that he's not a senator, and was actually the chairman of Lincoln Savings and Loan, who Black accused of doing favours for the savings and loans in exchange for contributions. And Arizona Senator John McCain was one of the Keating Five. He, along with the rest of the senators, was reprimanded, but otherwise unpunished. Now, ladies and gentlemen, you're going to want to pay a lot of attention to this episode, because also in the second hour, we've got a New Zealand blogger, Evelyn Gilbert, to come on to ask a few questions of Mr. Black, a few in-depth questions about financial crime, specifically how they relate to the current New Zealand Prime Minister John Key and his work history on Wall Street. Bill Black, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's a hell of a lot more professional intro than I normally give. So, I would like you to give me a little bit of a backgrounder about yourself and how you actually really got into economics of the scumbaggery kind.
Randomly, of course, I got a phone call asking me to become the litigation director of a pretty obscure federal agency in what turned out to be the early part of what we call here the savings and loan debacle, which cost $150 billion to resolve, or right around New Zealand's entire GDP. I accepted the job, and you know, it seemed like a sort of technical legal type job, but it turned out that we were having just one failure after another, and we were being overwhelmed. So we decided to not simply react to these things, but to look at them in depth and try to figure out what was going wrong. We called this the autopsy process. We looked at every failure starting in 1984. And, you know, you're talking about roughly 100 of these failures and eventually a couple of hundred per year. And we looked for patterns. And what we discovered, nobody thought it was fraud. But what we discovered was a pattern that only made sense if it was fraud. And it was a fraud that involved using accounting. So there are folk songs in the United States about, you know, you can steal a whole lot more money with a pen than you can with a revolver. And that turned out to be very true. So as the inevitable in the U.S. context, National Commission to Investigate the Causes of the Savings and Loan Debacle would report years later, fraud was invariably present. That was their word, invariably, at the typical large failure.
Well, how many bankers actually went to jail for this fraud?
We got over 1,000 felony convictions, and that's just in cases designated as major by the Department of Justice. But that understates the degree of prioritization. Because we worked very seriously with the FBI to create what was called the top 100 list. This is the 100 worst fraud schemes in the savings and loan industry. It involved 300 different savings and loans and a bit over 600 senior people. Virtually all of them were prosecuted. They have the best criminal defense lawyers in the world. America still does some things well. And they will spend money like water because it's often the bank paying for it to try to keep the CEO out of prison. Despite that, we got a 90% conviction rate.
That whole spending money like water thing, is that sort of why fraud is so corrupting?
No, that's one of the reasons it's hard to prosecute elites. After all, the corporation will pay for their defense. And what do they care about budget? They care everything about staying out of prison and nothing about the shareholders. And if you have an unlimited budget for your legal defense, you can do a whole lot more. The other big thing people forget, a huge advantage in elite white collar crime, is you get to talk to your lawyer in advance, before and while you're committing the crime. And he or she gets to help advise you. And therefore, you don't make anywhere near as many blunders as the typical felon does
so
that makes it much easier as to prosecute.
They don't have lawyers per se. They have criminal advisors.
They have people who function very much like co-conspirators, but are called lawyers. We always love this part. They will always tell us, we being the regulators, my ethical duty is to give zealous defense of my client. And you go, okay, but for the great bulk of this time, your client was the bank, not the CEO, right? The bank was the victim being looted by the CEO. So you weren't actually giving zealous defense of your client. You were helping the CEO destroy your client, which doesn't seem very ethical.
Well, you know what they say, the brighter the picture, the darker the negative.
That's so true.
Well, what kind of damage do these people do? Because everybody thinks about, let's say they get $100 stolen off them in the street by somebody who actually mugs them at knife point. And they think, man, that's a really bad person. I'm really shaken up about that. What kind of damage does it do to a person or do to society when people steal billions?
Okay, so this is one of the things we emphasize as white-collar criminologists, and that is that elite white-collar crimes cause not only vastly larger financial losses than all the blue-collar crimes combined, but actually cause more deaths, more people being severely injured, And as you say, also cause a corruption of the entire system that breaks down democracy and turns it into a sham in many of these circumstances. So a classic example of this is infant formula in China, where it's been a scam for a long time to, in essence, put the equivalent of chalk in with water and sell it as if it was infant formula. And China has seen this scam a number of times, and so it developed a test that looked for protein, because this chalk-like stuff has no protein. And the illegal manufacturers therefore switched and put melamine in to water. Melamine causes kidney stones in infants as young as 2 months old. At least 6 infants were killed, but 300,000 were hospitalized. And every honest manufacturer of infant formula was driven out of the marketplace, because how can you compete? Water and melamine are a whole lot cheaper than using milk.
What I love about that scandal as a New Zealander is that Fonterra, the New Zealand company that demanded that the melamine be put into the formula in order to liven up the costs, blamed the Chinese for adding it in.
Well, and of course there are, you know, Nestle's and all kinds of other entities have done lots of things with the infant formula, where they push new moms in the hospital to stop, to not nurse and to use instead formula, even though it's in countries where you don't have reliable, safe water. And of course, if you don't nurse from the beginning, it's next to impossible to take up nursing months later. So you're stuck in a system where you have unsafe water instead of nursing, you know, which not doesn't work for everybody, but works for the great bulk of moms. Earthquakes are another one, right? So this is in the news. New Zealand has suffered, pretty serious earthquakes. But
they're ongoing.
They are ongoing, and I spent 5 months in Ecuador. So Ecuador is just at a 7.8. Japan has had a series of these things. But in other places, these kill thousands and tens of thousands of people because of bribes. Right? Most of these places nowadays have actually decent seismic codes. They're typically modeled on California's codes, but they don't actually build to code because it's cheaper, right? Not to put in the rebar or to put in cheap rebar or only one-third the rebar that you're supposed to put in. And once the structure is tied up, you can't see whether the rebar is there as someone renting the building or buying the building.
And then as soon as it starts shaking, that rebar goes underlay.
It does. And the saying in the seismic world, of course, is that it's not earthquakes that kill people, it's buildings that kill people. And if you don't put in the rebar properly and you have multi-story buildings, the floors, we call it pancake. Just the floor above you collapses onto you, and maybe many floors above you collapse onto you. There's few miracle survivals, but enormous loss of life and many amputations, even among survivors from all of this falling stuff. So for very tiny bucks, you know, the extra profits you were getting by using not having milk in infant formula and adding melamine, people are actually willing to kill infants, right? And that's,
you know, that reminds
me of enormous taboo. It's really hard to get people to do that, but if you do it through a product, it's a whole lot easier.
Yeah, you've relieved it. I mean, you're not feeding the product to the child. You're not killing the child directly. So you're able to file it on a piece of paper and collect a paycheck and then go to bed at night, right?
Right. You never see your victim, typically. Volkswagen just did 11 million felonies. And that's just the original felonies. Then all kinds of felonies covering up their deliberate emissions violations and lies about their emission levels. So in the financial world, that which is what, you know, much of my work does, just in the United States, the most recent financial crisis is estimated over the course of the Great Recession that it will cost $24.3 trillion. Now, the word trillion is used in various parts of the world in different ways. This is 1,000 billion as I'm using that. It's just an impossibly large number. In America, 9.3 million American jobs were lost. 5 million jobs that normally would have been created were not created. Of Latino households in which the head of the household has a college degree or beyond, they lost over 70% of their total assets. That's the median loss. For blacks, again, households where the head of the household has at least a university degree, over 60% of their wealth was lost in this crisis. So we're talking about something that is devastating in the United States, but it's a very rich nation with enormous poverty in sections. But all of those loss figures that I've given you, the GDP loss, the loss of jobs, the loss of employment, and the losses of wealth are also being experienced in the Eurozone, and they are much larger because of the insanity, to put my economics hat on now, the insanity of austerity.
Hmm. It's like being raped with a phantom penis that just doesn't go away.
Lots of people in audiences have actually been victims of rape, so I don't use rape metaphors, but causes them a lot of pain. It certainly does mean what many people are figuring out. And that is, the system literally is rigged. And in places that won, and that should be in quotation marks, the race to the bottom, and that would be Wall Street, which finished second, actually, to the City of London, which won the race to the bottom and has ended up the financial cesspool of the world, with Wall Street only slightly behind. There you see that fraud and ripping off customers is literally the strategic plan. So let's take the United Kingdom.
How easy is it to do it? Like, let's say I want to, you know, I want to have like a 12-step program to frauding somebody and stealing a whole lot of money. What would I do?
Well, first, if you're really clever and you're in the UK in particular, you wouldn't actually do all the what we call the legal elements of fraud, because after all, some miracle could happen. There might be a real prosecutor in the modern world, and they might prosecute you the way we did back in the late 80s and the early 90s. So payment protection insurance. Have you ever done programs on payment protection insurance in the past?
Unfortunately, no, not since our last Harvard episode.
Okay, so this one is actually complicated, but I'll explain it in really easy ways. So you come in for any kind of loan in the UK, and they give you the loan, but they also add on an insurance policy. And this insurance policy says, if you get unemployed after a certain delay, you'll get a percentage of your income will be used to repay the loan for a while, okay? Now, here's what all you need to really know. The bank then turns around and sells that insurance policy to an insurance company. And it gets a commission. This is an actual court case. You get a commission of 78 cents on the dollar. All right? In other words, you have overcharged for your insurance. The bank has overcharged you so massively that the insurance company can give away 80 cents on the dollar and still pay any claims. Okay? Now, how often can they do that? They did that to the extent of 50 billion pounds. And this is when the pound was materially above things like the U.S. dollar. So, you know, somewhere in the range of 70 billion U.S. bucks, right? The UK parliamentary inquiry, which was run by the Tories, was not a friend exactly of consumers, said that this represented all of the profits of British banks in their branches for over a decade. Right? So they're literally, their business strategy was rip off customer. And I'll just give you one. This is just so classic Brit, right? So mostly they do this through compensation. They give you incentives to the little people to screw your customer, and, right? And if you sell enough of this payment protection insurance, you get actually a meaningful bonus even a little person in the banks. But that didn't work for a number of people who, you know, had this thing called ethics. and didn't want to rip off their customers. So at least some banks, what they would do, if you refuse to sell this crap and rip off your customers, they would force you to keep a cabbage on your desk. Now, these are the modern offices where, you know, it's completely open. Everybody can see that you've got a cabbage on your desk. And a cabbage, you know, in Brit parlance, is a dull, not very bright, not very ambitious person. Plus, cabbages are really visible. And over time, they begin smelling like sauerkraut. So this is a genius form of torture of your employee. They'll either leave, which makes you happy, because you're going to replace them with someone who isn't ethical, or eventually they'll give in. Either way, the bank wins. Or more precisely, of course, it's not the bank necessarily that wins. It's the senior officers that run the bank that win.
Because they get to collect the money and spend it while this is all kind of going on before the next financial year hits and the bank takes all the losses, right?
Right, even if there are losses. But this particular scam that I was talking about, the payment protection insurance, actually produces record income, of course, because you have massively overpriced. Now, if talked to conventional economists, then they would have assured you that this is impossible because banks would never do that to their customers. It would harm their reputation. And customers would never allow it to happen because customers are so sophisticated that they can see through any scam by the bank. Well, didn't turn out to be true. It turned out that probably over half the time they succeeded in selling this insurance. And this is not an overstatement I'm about to make. It is literally true. Not a single one of these policies ever should have been sold. Under economic theory, it would have been impossible to sell a single one of these policies. In fact, they succeed well over half the time. Tell you another one. This also this one's very similar mechanism. And this one exists in many places in the world whenever people are making loans. And in the United States, it's infamous when you get a car loan, and it's infamous when you get a house loan. So let's do the car loan, right? So you go in, you agree to buy a car, and the friendly car salesman says, hey, would you like help getting financing? You know, so you don't have to pay cash for this whole thing. And you say, yes. Okay. So the friendly guy at the car dealer sends in a form, has you fill it out that says, I got this kind of income, et cetera. And I have the following credit rating. And they send that form to the lender. The lender comes back and says, hey, for a person like customer like this with this kind of credit risk, we're willing to make the loan at 6%. I'm making up that particular number, but for many eras, it would have been in that ballpark. But if you can convince the customer to pay an above market rate of interest, then if you could convince them to pay 8%, I won't give you a $2,000 fee. I'll give you a $6,000 fee as a kickback. Right? That is how routinely auto financing was done in the United States. That was also in the run-up to the financial crisis, how mortgage lending was done. And one study found that they were successful, they being now the bank lending officers, were successful almost always in getting the customer to pay well above a market rate of interest. The other study said, no, they were only successful half the time. And they targeted, in the U.S. context, blacks and Latinos.
You see, this is why I part of the reason why I quit sales. So, you know, you sit there and you go, the guys who are lying are making more money than me because I won't lie. This is really pissing me off. I can't stand it.
You're a better person than I am. I got out of sales, which I only did as a kid, because I was too good at it and I didn't like what I was becoming.
I'd probably say that's actually partially the same reason as well. I remember my dollar sign shaped giant belt buckle with encrusted cubic zirconias on it. God, I was the shit. Anyway, I'm now a broke-ass activist with a sense of entitlement, which I think is a marked improvement. The great thing about doing things for the right reasons is that you don't have to worry about people bribing you to keep doing what you're doing, because they won't.
That is true, but the bad news about similar to your statement is, in the modern era, you don't have to bribe the regulators in places like the United States and the United Kingdom, because they're such ideological Ayn Rand types that they have been taught to believe that, you know, the banks really do look out for us and they do everything wonderful for us, so I don't really need to regulate them.
Yeah, see, this was something I've been getting into an argument with a couple of my right-wing mates about, and they seem to think that just because it's ideologically sound to be absolutely frivolous and have no regulations for banking systems and everything like that, that it works in practice when there's such overwhelming evidence that the money free-for-all gravy train frickin' apocalypse now giant bubble of shit in the sky of debt isn't gonna, it's not gonna work out well, bro. And you know this as well, bro. You know it's not good, and yet you're supporting the exact same ideology that allowed it to come into fruition. Is there a disconnect here? Is there a disconnect? I'm confused.
Yes, but it's by the way, it's something that we warn about a lot as criminologists. A lot of people think, oh, hey, I'm great. You know, my car doesn't get stolen. And it doesn't, not because it's hard to steal your car, because it's a lot easier to steal somebody else's car, right? I could steal your car, too. It would just take 10 seconds and I'd have to use a tool and maybe somebody might see me. So, you know, I'll go to wherever it's easiest. Well, the equivalent of that at finance is what I've just explained. There was so much more money. And it was so much easier to steal in the city of London and in Wall Street that why would you do it in Wellington?
That actually reflects a recent survey that came out in a New Zealand paper where they had the entire region of Auckland, every suburb mapped out to find out exactly where all the burglaries were committed. You know where all those burglaries got committed, ladies and gentlemen? In the rich neighborhoods where there's really good shit to steal? No, in the poor neighborhoods where the shit that you can steal is unprotected because you can't afford to protect it.
That's pretty much everywhere.
That's Wall Street in a nutshell, isn't it?
Well, it's why, again, complacency is a great danger. And places like New Zealand, places like Canada, are much too complacent, thinking, well, see, we went through this crisis and, yeah, we had a recession, but it was nothing like those twits in the city of London and Wall Street. Yeah, but God forbid someone, you know, would be appointed as a real regulator in Wall Street and people start looking, as you say, to Auckland.
Yeah, well, turkeys don't vote for an early Christmas. And as far as I know, they don't bribe the Father Christmas to come early either. The other thing that I wanted to get here is because New Zealand's now being seen as kind of like a tax haven worldwide, and we've got these Panama Papers that have come out implicating a hell of a lot of people, which me, as a very cynical, very jaded person, after looking at shit for in the news for a number of years, comes as absolutely no surprise because how could there not be endemic corruption among the ruling class of the world that is ongoing and continually growing unless all the people that started this big game went down in the first place? All right? There's a poison tree and it's dropping poison fruit.
Okay, so in the criminology biz and econ world, and regulation, we called this a Gresham's dynamic after a long-dead Brit economist named Gresham. And what it means is that bad ethics drives good ethics out of the marketplace. So I gave an example of that with infant formula. The obvious victims, and the one obviously that we should care about the most, are the infants. But honest business people are also driven out. And so when you really screw up regulation through things like this race to the bottom that I've been emphasizing, then you don't get simply an increase in fraud. You can actually get endemic fraud because honest people aren't able to function in the marketplace. And the example I gave to you was how you get your employees to do the wrong thing pervasively, which mostly is through sales incentives, but it's also things like cabbage. And people, it's wrong to underestimate them. They're often quite clever about manipulating people. And indeed, this is something we also emphasize. When a CEO goes bad, he or she doesn't, well, there are, you know, 3% of American CEOs are women. So he, when he goes bad, he doesn't have to learn a new skill set. The key skill set is to manipulate people. And that's what CEO's skill set is. You know, they use a more polite phrase, right? The ability to incentivize.
You know, that's actually another reason why I quit sales, because I realized that I was, you know, I developed this ability to really manipulate people if I wanted to. And I was like, okay, I don't think that's a good idea to be incentivizing that behavior, Vinny. How about you just, you know, just back off from this? This is not good.
Right. And so, indeed, we have Michael Jensen, a very libertarian, Ayn Randish type guy, very conservative econ prof, is the intellectual godfather of modern executive compensation. He complained that in the old days, CEOs weren't taking enough risks because they were, quote, paid like bureaucrats, unquote, which is the worst insult he could possibly give, right? That you're like a government person. And so we have now massively greater compensation, but not tied to real long-term performance by the CEO, right? And so Jensen has now done this mea culpa and said, I created a monster. And in surveys, now this is just a survey. This is, you know, where no one is forcing anybody to tell the truth. Over half of the chief financial officers, we call them CFOs, report that they manipulate earnings because of their compensation systems. Well, if that many are willing to admit that they do it, you know, think of your sales force. Think of what percentage actually do it. And all the studies come back and show, yeah, this produces a whole lot more fraud. But they refuse to fix it. And they refuse to fix it because when the economy gets screwed up, you get massive inequality in income. And the massive inequality in income throughout the history of humans has led to massive political power on the behalf of, you know, it's not even the one percenters, it's the 1,000th of one percenters who really have the control.
It's funny you should say that. I was once leading a protest for Occupy Auckland, and what was it, Shannon, through the megaphone? We are the 99.999%.
Well, that would be dead on. It's actually, in statistical jargon, it's the extreme tail of the distribution
The fractional reserve of the distribution, as it were.
Well, I actually think it has very little to do with that. You don't need fractional reserves
pun.
To do any of the things we've discussed.
The other thing here is tax havens, okay?
Yes.
Like my our wonderful Prime Minister in Chief, which we'll get into more in the second hour. He helped to set up some of these little tax haven sweetheart breaks in Ireland, before the Irish tiger economy. Yeah, our economy's booming. It's booming. It's gonna go. Oh my God! Yeah, and then it's gone.
Yeah, as you possibly know, I perform, I guess is the word, each year at Kilconomics, which is the most wondrous thing. You've got to come to this. This is in Kilkenny, Ireland, and it's a fusion of economists and professional comedians.
Oh, okay. I thought it was a fusion of economists and alcohol, but you know.
Well, no, there's that goes without state. You don't have to state that.
Well, of course. How else context. Would the economists? What else would the economists and comedians have to do together? You know.
Right, but one of the things is Trichet. If you recall Trichet, the second head of the European Central Bank. Famously came to Ireland during the Celtic Tiger bubble and said that Ireland should be the model for the new accession members of the EU, you know, Poland, places like this. Cato, a real right-wing place in the United States, said not only should Ireland prove our case that deregulation and ultra low taxes is the way to go, but Iceland is the other place that proves this. So all of these things prove to be lies. All of these record economies prove to be based on fraud. It's just that in Iceland, they actually it's small enough, and the people refuse to put up with it. They used Latin American techniques. So your listeners may be familiar with the casseroli. In Latin America, you go out.
I'm not actually familiar with that. I thought it was some kind of evening meal.
Right. Well, that of course it is. You cook the evening meal, you go out to protest, and you take the pan, and you bang on the pan with your big wooden spoon. Iceland, of all things, adopted this Latin American strategy in Reykjavik, and they have now brought down three governments within days. and they got real prosecutors. And so it's the only place in the world where each of the CEOs that led the major frauds have been imprisoned, right? Elsewhere, they're not even prosecuted, much less imprisoned.
Everywhere but Iceland gave them a warm reception, I guess.
Iceland's a lot warmer than you think. It's back to that geothermal.
Except if you're a criminal banker.
And where the straits are. So the currents actually keep it a lot warmer. But it is an example, as you say, of the critical need for real estate agents. Back to sales, right? The guy in charge of naming Greenland was a whole lot more of a real estate agent than the guy who named the place Iceland. Bad marketing.
Just want to talk to the guy who made the language. G'day, bro. Okay, now, tax havens. Five biggest tax havens. Apparently you know something about this.
So this is hotly disputed, but in almost anybody's list that's real, Delaware, the United States, would be in the top five and arguably number one in the top five. And the various Channel Islands would be probably number two, bigger than Switzerland. Switzerland would still be on these lists. The others actually would be more of the offshore islands that people think of and that the Panamanian place would deal with. But there were relatively fewer Americans on the list in the Panama Papers for a really good reason. Why bother to go to Panama when you can simply go to Delaware if you're an American?
Well, that is if you're aware of it.
Oh, and people. Okay, so all of these places are incredibly vulnerable to what we call sting operations in the United States. Do you use the same phrase?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so the nature of this beast is, as one of these law firms, you have to deal with the scum of the world, right? And so it's pretty easy to make up scum of the world. And since the whole nature of the business is not asking questions as the law firm and not doing investigations because they don't want to know, it's particularly easy. You don't have to have, we call it a legend. You don't have to make a sophisticated legend up and, sow the seeds in the electronic records to make it past real diligence. So one of the stories is, why have we not run stings on these places? For example, the Panama firm had branches in other places, including the United States at times, right? So we could have done stings. And indeed, by an accident of fate, the United States announced a major sting on the same day that it became public about the Panama Papers. We created a fake university. And we created a fake university to smoke out visa fraud, primarily by, in this particular case, Pakistanis, right? But we haven't done that. The Germans didn't do it, and they, you know, are allegedly all up in arms about Panama Papers. And Germany in the past has gone so far as to have its intelligence service pay money, in essence a bribe, to people who worked at Luxembourgian banks that were doing the tax havens to stick a thumb drive in and give them a list of the Germans who were evading taxes. The person who did that allegedly was paid somewhere in the range of $300,000 by the German equivalent of the CIA.
How exactly can they keep tax havens how they are? I mean, is it just as simple as there's a investigative chain and along those chains, everybody gets a taste and they prevent any investigation from progressing up the chain whenever it comes to them.
Well, there are enormous numbers of successful investigations on money laundering and sanctions violations. But the key is, so in the U.S. context, for example, we have enormous documentation that HSBC, one of the largest banks in the world that's based in the city of London, laundered over $1 billion for this Sinaloa drug cartel in Mexico. You know, this is a place where, you know, well over 1,000 people have been killed as a result of this unit. And they worked so closely with HSBC that they developed, the Sinaloa cartel developed special boxes that exactly fit the teller windows and the drive-up teller windows. So, you know, none of this inconvenience of moving big bundles of money back and forth in bulk. You just stick it all into this container. It's, you know, it's the equivalent of these truck and shipping containerization that revolutionized transportation. But this is to do money. All right. So we catch them. We catch them red handed. They're not even Americans, right? You're not going to get any political blowback. The United States Department of Justice prosecuted no one out of that HSBC. And the person who was in charge, the U.S. attorney, goes by the name Loretta Lynch. Now,
of Merrill Lynch?
No, of now she's appointed attorney general to replace Eric Holder, who failed to prosecute any bankers. Who did we elevate? Who did President Obama elevate? Someone that wouldn't even prosecute an individual for laundering $1 billion for drug cartels that were killing over 1,000 people.
Don't worry, I'm sure he was real sorry about it.
Well, actually, they weren't, because this had the agreement not to really prosecute has a special master who was supposed to look. When you said you were sorry, were you really sorry? Did you really clean up their act? And the answer he came back with was no. And you try, Loretta Lynch in the doing the deal said, oh, boy, you know, we're not prosecuting now, but boy, we're going to check. And boy, if they don't prove sincere and effective, we'll just be, you know, coming down with pick your absurd.
I can make a whole lot of really empty promises to make myself right. Look good temporarily in the public eye until this blows over when the media stops covering it. Okay, thank you very much.
Right. And then it happened and, well, nothing happened. And then the Huffington Post did an investigation and that found that HSBC was completely dirty and they did nothing. And now the Panama Papers show that HSBC was incredibly dirty again after it had supposedly agreed to clean up its act. And they do nothing again. Now, meanwhile, the Panama thing occurs because of this consortium of investigative journalists, not because of any regulators, not because of any prosecutors, right? So these journalists have zero subpoena authority to get the documents, and they still manage. Similarly, there's a tax justice group that ran its own sting in the United States, posed as sleazy clients trying to avoid paying taxes.
Which is commonly known as a subpoena implant.
Went into over a dozen major legal providers of these kinds of services. The only person who said no used to be the president of the American Bar Association. So that's pretty good in his case, kind of, sort of, except that he then said, but I'll make a referral. But the all others all said, sure, we can work something out. Well, if 11 out of 12 folks say yes, and the 12th says no, but I'll tell you, I'll put you in touch with people willing to do it. And that's the United States. All of this thing about how dare those terrible Panamanians, yada, 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 yada. Look.
Those terrible Panamanians. It's pandemonium down there.
That's right. So, you know, everybody that does anti-money laundering, anti-tax evasion, knows that this is really driven with the largest financial institutions in the world, with very prestigious lawyers, very prestigious accountants, and such. And that if you were rich, back to the 0.00001, you have these people. Now, back to the Gresham's dynamic. This is done frequently to avoid paying corporate income tax. Well, if I'm an honest business paying a corporate income tax, and in the United States, the nominal rate is pretty high, how can I compete with somebody? You mentioned Ireland. So in Ireland, they have something called the double Irish. You got to love it, right? The double Irish is you first in create the shell corporation in Ireland, and then it creates a shell corporation in the Caymans, and you literally, under U.S. law, don't exist as a U.S. corporation, and under Cayman law, you don't exist as a corporation. So
you don't exist at all.
You don't exist for tax purposes, but the you have to pay a rake off to Ireland, but it's tiny, right? So Ireland, like Luxembourg is fantastic. You get to go and you get to have a private meeting with their secretary. They're probably called the minister, the treasury ministry, right? And I don't mean the ministry. I mean the minister, right? You have a one-on-one meeting and it's let's make a deal. And they can literally cut your rate to 2%. Now, 2% for Luxembourg is huge, right? They got no population. Iceland is a giant country compared to Luxembourg in terms of population. So getting 1 or 2% from these major corporations means that you've got all these ultra-rich people. And guess which person started all of this as the Treasury Minister in Luxembourg, and then on the strength of that became the Prime Minister because of his great success, and then on the strength of that became the head of the European Parliament.
Herman von Rompuy?
This would be Juncker. Now, those of your listeners who know the Junkers, that was a class of minor aristocracy landowners. That phrase is actually a generic phrase.
So everybody got taken hook, line, and Junker.
Yes. And so simultaneously, this is the best part of this theater. All kinds of people were giving speeches in the European Parliament and the heads of state of the European nations denouncing all of this terrible stuff being done on taxes. And then they all went and voted for Juncker, the godfather of all of this, and made him the at least titular head of Europe.
The titular head of Europe. Sounds very erotic. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen. The Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. You're listening to American Freedom Radio. Bear in mind, this is listener supported. So if you would like to reach out and touch someone with your dirty, dirty money, give it to us at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. We could really, really cause some damage with it that won't hurt the economy. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? And my very special guest is Bill Black. Welcome back. Now, I even did that by accident. The four steps to financial fraud. This is something a friend of mine wanted me to ask you. I'm trying to get her connected up with me now so she can ask some of the questions herself about John Key. She's a blogger from New Zealand, and she was indeed the person who learned me up about you, because she kind of like, what did it remind me of? Ah, that's what it reminded me of. On my first year of radio, I got to interview George Norrie from Coast to Coast AM. We had like 29 million listeners, and I was like twiddling my hands and like skipping around the house like a little schoolgirl, you know, almost like pigtails for me. It was unbelievable. It was terrible. And then I was like, oh, here we go, I'm going to be with the George Norrie interview. And then I was talking to Evelyn about it, and she's going, oh my god, the Bill Black with the, and I was like, aha, I see it right there. She's going to want to speak to this fella right here. So Evelyn Gilbert from Aotearoa, A Wider Perspective, .wordpress.com. Welcome to the program as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
I'm very happy to be here today.
Yeah, I know. That was just so embarrassing that I just had to share it publicly. Now, you've got a series of questions here for Bill about our Prime Minister, John Key. Would you like to lead on from here?
Okay, my name's Evelyn Gilbert, and I run a blog, Aotearoa, A Wider Perspective, and I've been following your writings and interviews for a while, and I thought it would be incredibly interesting for New Zealanders to hear from you. So I talked to Vinny, and we got together, and the result is that we're here, the three of us are here now, and I got some questions. Have you been looking into the New Zealand situation at all?
I've been following very closely the escape of Inky.
Of?
Inky.
Well, he's a slippery character he was, yeah.
Well, as a criminologist, you got to love an aquarium break.
Yes, absolutely, and especially of one of his magnitude.
Well, let's put it this way. I've been following it closely enough that I was wondering when Vinny was talking about pigtails, whether that was a setup to the Prime Minister's penchant for pulling on waitresses' pigtails.
No, it wasn't a deliberate one. I'm just that magnificently lucky.
Okay, so... one of the questions I had was, because you've been following what happened in Ireland, and in one of your interviews, you specifically mentioned Merrill Lynch as an example of a bank who was using the new derivatives, etc. And I was really interested to hear more about that.
Sure. So Merrill Lynch was one of the five largest investment banks in the United States. Three of those five massive investment banks, Merrill Lynch, Bear Stearns, and Lehman, failed. And Bear and Merrill were acquired by other massive systemically dangerous banks. So, you know, their problems are not resolved. Merrill was infamous for what we call eating your own cooking. Which might not sound like a bad thing, but was particularly interesting in these circumstances. So here's the scoop. And to do this, we do need a little cooking recipe. So this is the recipe for how you run these accounting frauds, either as a lender or an entity like Merrill Lynch that buys the loans that the lenders make. And so this fraud recipe has four ingredients. One, grow like crazy. So this is 25, 50% a year, if at all possible. Two, by, if you're a lender, making really crappy loans, but at a higher interest rate. Or if you're a purchaser, like Merrill Lynch, by buying really crappy loans, but at a higher interest rate. Three, while using extreme leverage, that just means a whole lot of debt compared to equity. And four, while setting aside only trivial amounts of reserves, loss reserves, for the inevitable massive losses that you're going to get. Now, if you follow that recipe, there are three sure things. First, the entity, like Merrill Lynch, will, in the early years, it's mathematically guaranteed, if it follows that recipe, to report extraordinary earnings. Two, second sure thing, is under modern executive compensation, the executives, and I don't just mean the people in the C-suites, the CEOs and the CFOs, but all through an entity like Merrill Lynch, those officers are going to be made wealthy. And three, down the road, some years, it's going to produce catastrophic losses, which is why three of the five investment banks don't exist. So Merrill Lynch buys stuff from all these lenders who have terrible reputations, just awful, awful reputations for creating fraudulent product. And there are these huge warnings. The FBI in 2004 warns that there's an epidemic of mortgage fraud and predicts it will cause a financial crisis. And the words epidemic and crisis are their actual words that they use. And this was public. It was not some obscure thing. It got a lot of coverage in the press.
Okay, so our prime minister, who was instrumental, he used to work for the Bankers Trust Bank. And when that bank collapsed in 1995 because of their fraud, he was quoted as saying, "When all shit hit the fan, I was out of there." And so he moved to Merrill Lynch in 1995, and he was instrumental in setting up the Merrill Lynch Wealth Management Fund in Ireland. But he said that when Merrill Lynch collapsed, that was because after he left, the bank wasn't managed very well. Do you agree with him, or would you say that that was very much the rot set in much, much earlier?
No, and that's why I'm emphasizing these dates. So again, by 2004, the FBI was already saying there was an epidemic of mortgage fraud. By the year 2000, the appraisal associations, I don't know what phrase you use in New Zealand for what we call an appraiser. This is the person that values a home.
Yes.
They're sometimes called assessors in other places, things
realtors.
Like that.
You would call them assessors, probably.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. So they publicly, in a public petition that eventually 11,000 appraisers signed, warned that they were being extorted by the lenders to inflate their appraisals. Now, no honest lender would ever do that because the value of the collateral is what protects you from loss. Again, that's really early, the year 2000. By the year 2006, the industry's own anti-fraud experts are reporting that 90% of the loans called liar's loans are fraudulent. And by the way, 40% of all the mortgage loans made in the United States in 2006 were liar's loans. And by the way, that number in the UK was 45%. Of all of those loans. So on A, Merrill Lynch knows all these things. But B, Merrill Lynch hires entities, it's a particular one called Clayton, that look at these loans that are being sold to it. And this entity, Clayton, is not designed to be a tough grader. It's designed, you know, not to find problems. But the problems are so pervasive for the reasons I've talked about that they find, in fact, 46% of the time, the representations and warranties that the lender makes in selling the mortgages to Merrill Lynch are false. So as I always ask students at this point, so how many of you would keep buying from Amazon if 46% of the time they lied to you, right? Honest business people wouldn't do that. But it gets worse because Merrill Lynch then makes fancy financial derivatives, which it, by the way, sells to lots of the folks in those wealth funds that you talked about. But it also sells to our pension funds. And it sells to little towns in Norway and tiny banks in Germany, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? And when Merrill Lynch sells these fancy derivatives that are made up of all these toxic waste mortgages that I've just talked about, Merrill Lynch never discloses, oh, by the way, you know those representations and warranties that I gave that said this is all good stuff? No, I'm lying to you. It's crap, right? So that's called fraud.
So if, for example, here we have a pension fund, and it's called the Cullen Fund, after the minister who started it. And one of the first, it started in 2002, and on its first board of guardians, a Merrill Lynch banker was asked to step in, and he was a guardian, and he was supposed to guard the investments that the Cullen funds were made. He was from New York. He was a New Zealander, so it's very likely that our prime minister, who was at that time banking with Merrill Lynch, was involved. He was banking with Merrill Lynch during the Enron scandal. And he was a foreign exchange and the bonds and derivatives head of Merrill Lynch at that time. So if a Merrill Lynch banker takes place on the board of guardians of a pension fund, would that indicate that they will probably try and fill that pension fund with worthless derivatives?
Well, before you ever even get there, you have the same heritage of expressions that we have. And this, of course, all over the world is called by some variant of putting the foxes in charge of the chicken coop. You would never, ever, ever put somebody from an investment bank on as a guardian. That's crazy. In fact, it's so crazy, it's humorous crazy, right? As your promos.
Except that 4.5 million New Zealanders are hoping that the Cullen Fund is still filled with $29 billion. But when they were named the most innovating pension fund 2 years ago and they got a prize in Europe, I thought, nah, there is not a single piece of paper in that fund left.
Well, you've got to admit, that's pretty innovative.
Yeah. Well, do you know which corporation in America 3 years in a row won the title by Fortune of most innovative company? It'd be one you just mentioned, Enron. And you are also correct that Enron, Merrill Lynch was notoriously dirty on Enron. But this will help with the broader picture of why all these frauds were allowed to occur, right? So it wasn't just Enron. It was every major bank that was approached by Enron agreed to aid and abet an accounting fraud scheme. It's a little complex. I won't go through the details. But this is in the early days. So we're talking about 1999, 1998, these type of things.
Around the time of the repeal of Glass-Steagall, you mean?
Yes, and also exactly. Also before the wave of prosecutions that Enron and WorldCom failures set off. So people weren't being as careful about their emails in this era. And so when Enron fails in the United States, there's a procedure where, in this case, a bankruptcy trustee was appointed. So again, this is not the regulators. This is not the prosecutors. This is just the bankruptcy trustee starts looking into these claims of these banks because they're saying, hey, we lent all this money to Enron. We want it, we want to be claimants in the bankruptcy. But it turned out they were actually aiding and abetting Enron's officers to defraud. And so their claims were wiped out. Now, the head, the longtime head of supervision at the Federal Reserve, a major supposed financial regulator in the United States, And this is a guy who is not noted for being, you know, exactly incredibly vigorous. He's a careful, competent person. But he says, this is a disaster. Every major bank eagerly aided these frauds. And it's one of the largest frauds in history. I've got to go to the full leadership of the Federal Reserve, which was then run by this guy named Alan Greenspan, the Ayn Rand devotee. And we've got to get them to crack down on these kinds of scam companies, these partnerships, which, by the way, were then a major part of the new crisis that we've just all gone through. So he briefs the entire leadership of the board, and the entire leadership of the Federal Reserve is furious after the briefing at its own supervisors for daring to criticize the banks.
You know, so how this, can I just say something here? Because this is interesting how the frauds can be so big, involve so many people, indeed the effect of it on the economy be so enormous, and yet people don't know about it, right? Now, as an economics professor, you would know that a lot of people understand economics to have its own special language, a language that the public doesn't share. So when the people who are the economists run around waving their arms in the air, screaming out fraud, the economy, the stock market, this kind of thing, it's not entirely dissimilar from when you see somebody in the middle of the street going, they don't even know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, but the economists did no such thing, right? They didn't give a warning even in tongues. So what they did was exactly the opposite. And again, Alan Greenspan is a classic example. Now, you mentioned early on that we blew the whistle, my regulatory counterparts and I, the four of us who met with the five U.S. senators who became known as the Keating Five, where they tried to pressure us not to take enforcement action against the largest regulatory violation our agency had ever found, right? So one of the experts for the institution, and the guy for the fraud, Charles Keating of Lincoln Savings, and a guy who Keating hired to personally recruit the five senators to go after us, was a guy named Alan Greenspan, who also opined in writing that Lincoln Savings posed, and I'm quoting, no foreseeable risk of loss to the federal insurance fund. Well, it just cost $3.4 billion and was the largest bank failure in U.S. history until the new crisis. So he was just slightly wrong. After he was as wrong as it is humanly capable of being wrong, after that, he was appointed by President Reagan to run the Federal Reserve because he was willing to say whatever needed to be said, even if what he said was absurd. And then flash forward to you pointed out about the repeal of Glass-Steagall. But the other thing that was done that fits into what Evelyn is talking about is the creation of a massive regulatory black hole for financial derivatives. And that was done through passage of something called the Commodities Future Modernization Act of 2000, also under Bill Clinton. So this was a bipartisan effort in the U.S. context between the Republicans and the Democrats. And the whole purpose was to squash the only real regulator of this entire basically 20 years. She had proposed to regulate these financial derivatives.
Okay, so how does the
sentence in all of this. Her name was Brooksley Bourne. Greenspan meets with Brooksley Bourne, says, you and I are obviously going to disagree about a lot of things. Now, this is the first time they've ever met, And these are the first words out of his mouth other than hello. So she thought that was kind of strange. And she said, well, what are we going to disagree about? And he said, fraud. And she's going, how can anybody disagree about fraud? He Greenspan says, you probably think stopping fraud is a reason for regulation. I don't. So if you have, back to your point, if you put the leading foxes in the world, the economists who ideologically are opposed to any effective government regulation in charge of the regulators, in charge of the New Zealand pension fund, bad things are going to happen.
It's like you're getting the most elite foxes, fox regiment in the world that are just covered in blood, feathers, and egg. And you just go, hey, bro, do you want a job looking after me chooks? You know, they're right over there. Go for your life, son. Evelyn, okay, I'm so sorry. So go ahead.
Can I, how does the Foreign Exchange Advisory Committee fit into this?
I don't know. we don't have a Foreign Exchange Advisory Committee.
Okay. So,
we have a freely floating dollar. And there's no reason to have an Exchange Advisory Committee.
Okay, because the Federal Reserve, John Key, our Prime Minister, was invited by his boss to take place on the Foreign Exchange Committee for the Federal Reserve in New York. And he shared that place at the time with Robert Rubin, another one of those wonderful characters that sort of floats around in the scum layer, shall we say. And that was in 1998, when he was still working for Merrill Lynch. And he was running the derivatives departments, the foreign exchange and derivatives departments.
Well, so let me take that in pieces. First, obviously, this shouldn't happen for the reasons that we've gone through. Second, this one probably doesn't much matter compared to anything we've been discussing, because the U.S. doesn't just lets the dollar float. It doesn't set the dollar through any such committee and such. But your broader point about Robert Rubin is a particularly good one, because Robert Rubin was, within the Clinton administration, the biggest advocate of killing Glass-Steagall. And they had come very close to success in a number of years, but never quite been able to get the votes. So Citigroup decided on a really nasty strategy. It arranged a merger with Travelers Insurance, a massive insurance company. It was the largest financial merger in world history. And it was in complete violation of Glass-Steagall. And so under the act, you're allowed to buy some, you know, do a merger, but you had to get rid of activities that weren't allowed under Glass-Steagall within 2 years. But of course, if you create the largest financial entity in the world and then you have to rip it apart in 2 years, God only knows what you're going to produce, and maybe something really, really bad. So this was a deliberate attempt at extortion by Citigroup and Travelers to make it such that you would have to repeal Glass-Steagall. And as soon as it became clear that Glass-Steagall was going to pass, the destruction of Glass-Steagall was going to pass, Robert Rubin left the government as Treasury Secretary. And I know it will shock you, but ended up eventually being chairman of the board of the new merged Citigroup.
Of course. Of course.
It's at this point where you start to use Occam's razor, but it's a little bit of a different version called Fockham's razor. What's the worst possible outcome that you really definitely don't want to be true, and it makes you really feel uncomfortable that it means you have to actually do different stuff in your life if it were true? That's the one that is true. The other one sounds really rosy.
Well, this one, really, it's telling you something about your political system, right? It tells you your political system no longer works. Your ethical systems no longer work. They're not even bothering to hide things anymore.
Well,
In another interview, sorry, is that okay, Vinny?
Go for it.
In another interview, you are talking about the fraud in the setting the LIBOR rates. We know that some people have been arrested and convicted for LIBOR rate fraud, but you said at the time that it's much bigger than just a few individuals because 16 banks are involved in setting the LIBOR rates. Could you elaborate on that?
Yes. So these are 16 of the largest banks in the world. I have an article that details each of them, but it's by memory. It was the two or three of the largest banks in the United States, two of the or three of the largest banks in the UK, the largest bank in Germany, the largest bank in Netherlands, second largest bank in France, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all the big guys did this, and they did it at the highest levels. There's since the time of that interview, it remains true that they have not prosecuted anybody senior out of all of this. It's all still as if it were a rogue operation. That's the first thing, is an update. And the second update is that we now have additional information. And we have two aspects of additional information that are useful. One, in the trial, the successful trial in the United Kingdom, the first one of a particular individual, it came out that the document showed his superiors knew about this and were not being prosecuted. The second thing is that there was one of these flaky, not real investigations of Deutsche Bank about LIBOR. And this is where the board of directors gets together and they hire an accounting firm. And it's always the same. The accounting firm says, oh, you know, the people at the top were, you know, honest, wonderful folks, but there was somebody out in the hinterlands doing something bad. Okay, fine. But they did, in the course of that, end up talking to some fairly high executives. And here's the kicker. That fairly high executive was soon thereafter made the co-CEO of Deutsche Bank, one of the largest banks in the world. And he was explaining, his name is Jain, like the religion, and the Indian religion. He was explaining the reason he gave, approved a bonus to the two guys who it turned out were the key manipulators of LIBOR for Deutsche Bank. And collectively, these just two guys for just 1 year, their bonus was over 100 million euros.
Wow.
And Jain explained, yes, it seems like a big dollar amount, but you have to remember that these guys make us, and I quote, mountains of money, unquote.
So my understanding is that these 16 banks, they all come out every day at the same time and say, this is my LIBOR rate or our LIBOR rate. And then the bottom ones get scrapped, the top ones go scrapped, and the middle ones get, you get a median calculation, and that is the LIBOR rate of that day. Is that correct?
That's how it's supposed to work. You are correct that they lop off the bottom four and the top four, and they take the middle eight.
So
but
if
that's
only
not how
one,
it really worked.
No. So if only, say, four banks decide to put in a much higher one, they'd be the ones lobbed.
Correct.
But, so,
sorry.
So for the fraud to actually be able to be perpetrated, all 16 banks would have to be in on it.
As a practical matter, that's true. And this comes back to something we've been discussing. They didn't really keep this very secret, right? And so the way it was officially came out is so sad, again, is to be almost hilarious. What you were talking about earlier, Evelyn, the New York Fed is this weird entity that has largely private ownership and leadership, yes, controlled by the Wall Street banks. But it does governmental operations. In particular, it does all the trading for U.S. securities by the Federal Reserve, right? The yes, Federal Reserve, the governmental agency, uses the New York Fed trading desk to actually do the buy and sell. Okay, so there are regular traders, with that's with a D as opposed to a T, at the New York Fed. And they have these counterparts, right, at the big banks. And so they, in the modern era, they chit-chat in instant messaging and email and stuff. And the LIBOR guys for the banks tell the Fed gal, in this case, you know, the LIBOR numbers aren't real, right? They're rigged. It's like, what? And so the Fed trader doesn't seem terribly upset about this, but in fairness to her, she reports it up the line at least, where it gets to Tim Geithner, the head of the New York Fed, who will be, after a history as a complete and total regulatory failure as president of the New York Fed, where he was supposed to regulate the largest bank holding companies in America, completely failed in that function. The new President Obama decides to make him his Secretary of the Treasury, right? But anyway, it comes up to Geithner. Now, Geithner isn't upset in the least. Geithner writes this famous letter, or actually memo, to his, to the head of the UK Central Bank and to the head of what was then the FSA, the Financial Surveillance Agency, right? The super regulator for England. Now, but that
otherwise
letter,
known as the dreaded FUSA.
Right. Well, actually, there's a comedy satirical program that just has wonderful names for all these British entities that does its thing in the UK. But anyway, this memo, first, Geithner doesn't make a criminal referral. Now, to back up, LIBOR is the largest cartel, illegal cartel, in the history of the world by three orders of magnitude. That means it's over 1,000 times larger than any cartel we've ever seen before. And Geithner is told flat out it's a cartel. They're rigging the number, and he doesn't even make a criminal referral. Instead, he sends this memo, as I said, over to the UK. But the memo doesn't say, hey, you're running the largest cartel in world history. Stop it immediately. Instead, it says, you know, you could tweak how you run this thing. And the primary tweak, and you can't make this stuff up, is you should add more American banks. So he just turned it into a business development opportunity. And in his memoir, he brags about this, about he how he's the guy that blew the whistle on LIBOR.
Well, that's another thing as well. New Zealand Prime Minister John Key's autobiography or something like that came out, what was it, just before his second election, I think?
I think so, yeah.
And
yeah,
in that book, it didn't mention the word derivatives once. And he was the head of European bond and derivatives for 2 years as Merrill Lynch's representative on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
In fact, I would go further. I wrote this initial post about would you have voted for John Key if you had known about how he was involved in the first derivative attacks on a currency, namely by a man called Andrew Krieger, in which he was the counterpart here in New Zealand. in 1987, where they made $300 million in one afternoon. And Frank Partnoy calls that the patient zero in the derivatives trade. So this is how far John Key goes back in the derivatives trade. And I've lost my train of thought completely.
Who would have thought that a man named Krieger would be responsible for so many New Zealanders' nightmares?
Well, I may be able to help you get back because I didn't address one of your earlier points that was well worth discussing. Before Glass-Steagall was repealed, that we talked about in 1999, we discussed this about Rubin, it was largely gutted through interpretations and regulatory changes by Alan Greenspan. I told you he was appointed by Ronald Reagan, but he was reappointed by President Bill Clinton, right? So this is the guy who largely destroyed Glass-Steagall enough that entities like Bankers Trust, which you mentioned earlier, with the prime minister's employment. Bankers Trust was the first big one to blow up in the United States.
Isn't Bankers Trust an oxymoron?
It proved to be a regular moron.
Okay. All right.
The bankers, from what I understand, is there were the Bankers Trust tapes that were released in a court case from a huge corporation, the name escapes me now at the moment.
Hallmark.
Hallmark and a German one. Anyway, they accused Bankers Trust Bank of fraud. And the Bankers Trust tapes actually said there was a word they had for how much they could rip their customers off, which was the rip-off factor. And from what I remember is that they collapsed in 1995 as a result of that.
They suffered serious losses. They had to settle for hundreds of millions of dollars in the lawsuits that you're talking about. Your memory is broadly correct on this. And as a result, they were acquired by Deutsche Bank.
Deutsche Bank, yes, indeed. Yes.
Which went on to the fame that we were just talking about with the mountains of money and the eager participants in gimmicking LIBOR. So LIBOR was scammed in two different eras and two different ways. In the first era, it was scammed so that you look brilliant on your trades, right? So if we bought and sold derivatives, it'd be really risky because derivatives can change their value a great deal based on little changes in interest rates, right? So that's why they're gimmicking LIBOR, is to change the interest rates that are reported and that are used to price these instruments. So we don't control interest rates. We can't figure out what the interest rate tomorrow is going to be. So we're subject, if we play in that game, we're going to lose, right? We'll be the sucker in the market. But hey, you can look like a genius. You can make mountains of money, to quote Deutsche Bank again, if whether you make a good bet or a bad bet on interest rates doesn't matter because you just change the interest rate by falsely reporting a fictional number that makes you make money on the trade. So that's the first one. And there are fabulous internal messages and emails from these folks that show just how complete scum they are. I mean, these are people that you would never want to marry your most collateral relative who you hated desperately.
Okay,
the the second phase, though, they were trying to hold down LIBOR. And they were trying to hold down LIBOR because they were trying to pretend that they were really healthy banks. And if you're a really healthy bank, you don't have to pay as much, as high an interest rate. So those are the two different scams. As I say, they're mostly in two different time periods.
Okay. A professor in Sydney who is specialized in accounting, governmental accounting, said in 2011 that she was extremely worried about the amount of derivatives that were off the books of our government. And at the time, she reported $112 billion worth of derivatives on the books, and it's only gone up. As well as that, when National and John Key became the government in 2008, there was about $18 billion worth of debt. And that has now gone up to about $114 billion. What is your opinion on both those?
So let's take the first part. There's a technical problem in any time you talk about the quantity of financial derivatives, because a lot of these things are offsetting positions. In other words, they bet in opposite directions. And so their net exposure is likely significantly smaller than the numbers you gave. That said, yeah, the New Zealand's GDP is ballpark $160 billion. So yes, you have a huge, huge portion at risk in derivatives markets. Now, I'm guessing in this next part that the defense would be New Zealand is very exposed to losses on commodity prices, right? And so we were just hedging against the risk of big changes in oil prices or big changes in, you know,
dairy.
Sheep.
In our case, dairy.
Dairy, sheep, you know, these types of things. And it is not like all derivatives are evil. Derivatives in agriculture have existed in some places like the United States, parts of Europe, Japan for hundreds of years.
Yes.
These can be perfectly prudent. So you have to, I don't know the details. You have to find out the details on that. But
wouldn't that be more for personal, like, for example, big farmers or Fonterra, our dairy cooperative, wouldn't that be prudent if they did that hedging rather than the government?
Yes. And so if the figure is a pure governmental number, then as opposed to government and industry, then that's something very odd is happening. And here's, again, the fundamental economics. It depends on what kind of derivatives. There are two broad classes. One class is exchange traded. That means that they're essentially, you can substitute one for another. In technical terms, they're fungible. And the commission that a place like Merrill Lynch in the old days would make is tiny on those. And then there are over-the-counter or OTC derivatives, where it's, let's make a deal. You come to the investment bank, or more precisely the investment bank, Vinny, back to salespeople. These are all sales guys and a few sales gals.
This is John Key's specialty.
This is his specialty, is you get people to buy things they shouldn't buy. And you get, instead of buying exchange traded, which has a very tiny profit markup, you get them to buy over the counter because there's a very large profit markup. And so, yes, that is the key. If you're an investment banker, you try to find the fool in the market. And it's often the folks who, for ideological reasons, over the fact that they're simply not very good at economics or don't care a whole lot about the people of New Zealand, are easy. You tell them, you know how you make the pitch, right? You say, oh, you're a sophisticated person. Regular people couldn't understand the need for these and the real extra profit opportunities. But because of your financial expertise and your willingness your knowledge that risk is ubiquitous in finance, and therefore you must take some risk, and that this is the key for the future of the Kiwis, yada, yada, yada. It's all BS, and you get a very fat commission.
Okay. what happened was I wrote this article, and now I'm back on track again, this article about his involvement in the derivatives trade. And there was an article out before his election, 15 pages online, five of which detailed his banking history, in which he said, I was heading the department for all these new instruments. He was quoted as speaking with all these wealth funds, with pension funds, and selling them this stuff. And when I pointed this out, because I accused people of, you know, they should have pointed this out before the election, they took all that information on the New Zealand Herald, five pages of it, they took all of that off. But he is... So he is, and I can send you the information because I got the paper, of course, the paper article. But rather than confronting him about that, they took all the information about his derivatives trade and how he was heading the department that was developing all these beautiful new over-the-counter. He was actually quoted as over-the-counter. That was his specialty, and that's where the real money was. So this is why that has my interest.
New Zealand's a pretty small place, especially when you think about the politics and media. Like, one dynamic I really love is the former CEO of MediaWorks, which is the largest private media company in New Zealand, became the government communications minister and then brokered a $40 million bailout for his former company that it won't have to pay back. And then the new CEO of that company turns out to be a private friend of the current prime minister, and then a radio station that company owns fires a radio DJ who'd been on the same slot for 9 years without even calling him, and then gave that radio slot to the prime minister's son, Max Key.
So, again, what have we seen consistently out of this? At least two things. One, it's the failures who get promoted. And they get promoted precisely because they're useful. They're willing to say anything, do anything. They don't have the ethical constraints. They don't have professional expertise that they care about in terms of a reputation. And second, what we always emphasize in fraud and abuse, the key is not genius. The key is audacity. And that's what you're seeing time after time in the examples we've talked about. So the French saying, of course, is l'audace, encore l'audace, toujours l'audace. Audacity, more audacity, always audacity. And my apologies for my accent. For anyone who actually speaks French.
Okay. Now...
So what you're saying here is, because you are the one who coined the phrase control fraud. That's an idea that you fleshed out and that would this be your typical kind of control fraud where John Key, being in a position of trust and in power, corrupts the controls and pushes other people below him to lose controls and deregulate so that he can gain, he and his companions can gain, win out of this.
I want to jump in here because it sounds a lot like the form of corruption known as state capture, where you get influence at the parliamentary level in order to get it to pass favorable legislation for your company.
So let me define the terms first. You're quite correct that control fraud is something that I'm one of the key developers. It just means that people who control a seemingly legitimate entity, whether that's in the private sector, the NGO sector, or government, as you've just said, in terms of capture, and use that seemingly legitimate entity as a weapon to defraud others. So Merrill Lynch, Bankers Trust, these were clear control frauds. Now, I've also explained that fraud isn't the only thing you can do with this control. So much of the payment protection insurance in the UK that I was discussing is fraudulent, but much of it is doesn't meet the element of fraud. You haven't actually said something through deceit necessarily. You're simply ripping off your customer. So the fraud isn't the only way you can abuse your authority in these circumstances. And you've just given me in the media context, for example, in New Zealand, these things are, as described, largely are not frauds. After all, they're not deceiving. They're out front publicly doing things like this. It's rude. It's abusive. It is corrupt. But there are lots of ways to use power to corrupt systems without actually committing the elements of fraud.
In the world that we live, and we're coming down to the wire here as this episode ends, do you think in your lifetime that we'll see an end to this corruption and overturning of it, or could it conceivably go on for a long time to come?
Oh, no, it will go on for eternity because humans are humans, right? So we, in criminology, discourage any military metaphors, all this war on this, that, and the other thing, right? Because it suggests there can be a decisive battle and you win and fraud is over. No, fraud exists for really good reasons that we've talked about. It's often a sure thing where someone who isn't all that talented running Merrill Lynch and Bankers Trust or officers at those places can be made immensely wealthy through a sure thing. And as long as those temptations, those perverse incentives exist, some portion of people are going to give in to them. But the additional question we've been addressing is, okay, so we know sometimes somebody's going to be fraud or take a bribe, but when does it become a really major problem? When does it become an endemic problem? When does this elite, this 0.0001, not only have dominant power, but corrupt power? When do they become kleptocrats, right, who are basically thieves? And that's when you have gutted your systems of justice, when you've gutted your political system, where you have non-competitive system, where one party has stayed in power way too long and has gotten to love the perquisites of unchallengeable power.
Unchallengeable power. That's the problem, isn't it? That's the entire reason why people get really angry, well, they quit their jobs and they start fighting against these kind of scum, right? It's because they have that feeling of powerlessness, and the only way that they can get back a feeling of having any power is by taking some personal responsibility for solving the problems that, made them powerless in the first place.
Yeah, and to end on that optimistic note, we ended up, as I said, convicting over 1,000 felons. We ended up taking on many of the most senior politicians in America. By any logical view, our cause was absolutely hopeless. And in fact, we, for a time, created an enormous transformation. But every generation has to join this struggle.
Thank you for giving me hope, and thank you, Vinny, for allowing me in this conversation. It's been wonderful.
Thanks. Wonderful meeting you.
Yeah, and thank you, American Freedom Radio, for giving me a show all those years ago so that I can then give it to other people, because ultimately a gift is not really that useful unless it can be repackaged and given to a relative. All right, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to the Vinny Eastwood Show. This is listener-supported. You pay for this, and you're definitely not getting your money's worth. But give us more money anyway, all right? Because that's what fraudulent derivatives is all about. We'll see you again sometime at the Vinny Eastwood Show.com.